Happy, happy, joy, joy. Oh, Ren, I'm listening to my favorite podcast about fly fishing. Good. Now zip up your fly and get out. You and your stupid podcast. You fool. Get out. I shall kill you.
Hey man, what is up?
Yo, what's up, party people?
What's up?
What's up? Live from a highly classified podcasting skiff, it's another episode of Secret Society of Fly Tires. Even though you paid for it and I coordinated it, it's still an honor to have Billy West talk about my show. He gave me some of my biggest laughs as a kid, and now he's making me laugh as a broken old skeleton man. As this season has progressed, I feel like I've aged 10 years, but it's only been about 6 months. Maybe I slipped through a crack in space-time. Maybe the Matrix is playing games with me. Maybe my life is going down the tubes.
But that's my life, you fucking asshole pricks. We get some more laughs in the monitors.
See what I did there? That is the topic of today's episode. Tubes.
Oh, baby, I love your tube.
Not my personal tube. That would be X-rated, and this is not the pornographic program. At least not yet. And you know that. I can't believe you even tried to go there. Get your mind out of the gutter.
Why don't you make me?
Why don't you make me?
Because I don't make monkeys. I just train them.
People tie flies on little non-sexual tubes and make them look realistic enough that fish think they're food. It's the basics of the hobby this show is about, you goose or geese. Only you don't tie your fly onto a hook or a shank, you tie your materials onto a little plastic tube. The idea alone sounded pretty weird to me when I first heard about it, but it made more and more sense the longer I pretended not to care about it. Just like half of the world is doing with the current state of UFO disclosure. I hope that you're like me and don't trust the government at all, no matter what the subject is, but I also hope that you start considering that these unidentified aerial phenomena are something real that we don't fully understand yet. No one is asking me, but I personally think it's something supernatural and more consciousness-based and not from outer space.
Yeah, you would think that.
That's just my opinion, and I have many very stupid opinions. That's why our country is cool, remember? We can have different, even stupid opinions and still be friends. It's possible. Anyways, we've been beaten down with constant information 24 hours a day for so many years now that unless it affects our everyday routine, we barely give a shit. I feel like we should all give a shit about this UFO stuff, though. People like me, who have been into the topic for a long time, have pretty much heard everything David Grush said at the big hearing before. But there were some interesting nuggets he divulged. He was asked a great question that I often ask myself and others by some cryptkeeper-aged government man. If these craft were traveling light years across space, why are they crashing here? If you read Diana Pasolko's book, American Cosmic, you learned about a place in New Mexico they refer to as the Gifting Field, where they basically pray at crude altars to find pieces of these exotic materials, and they do. The theory being that these so-called crashes and the pieces of anomalous metamaterials they find are meant to be found to either further our collective technology or to further the conversation about the phenomenon in general. Grush's answer to that question was pretty interesting, because he basically explained theories that the craft may not be coming from space at all, but could potentially be interdimensional or something even weirder. Friggin' hell yeah, man, let's get weird. That oversight committee hearing took place just a few days before the History Channel aired an episode of the show Beyond Skinwalker Ranch about one of my favorite ongoing cases, the Bledsoe family. It doesn't feel like a coincidence either. It's either a network playing their marketing cards right, or just getting lucky in that regard, or the people pulling the strings of quote-unquote disclosure liked the timing, or, to get weirder, the phenomenon itself decided it should air when it did to almost counteract whatever fear-mongering talk the government is doing with a positive example from a genuinely truthful-seeming experiencer. The government has been lying to us about their interest in the phenomenon since at least the 1940s if you count Roswell as being ground zero, which it most likely wasn't. Why is this happening now? Some people theorize that the phenomenon itself is in charge of its disclosure, and that the truth is coming whether anyone likes it or not, and that the government and intelligence agencies and private contractors are scrambling to get ahead of it. It seems pretty obvious that they want us to be afraid of it, and besides for it being some super weird unknown, which is always going to be kind of scary, it's been around for 100 plus years and hasn't wiped our stupid asses off the planet yet, and we continue to do many things that could very well call for that kind of intervention in those 100 years. So how am I supposed to believe that it's a threat to us? They keep bringing up instances where people were injured or even killed during experiences with the phenomenon. On the flip side of that, there are cases where people have been miraculously healed of their ailments after encounters. There's some respected researchers in the field, like my boy Grant Cameron, who have done extensive work with experiencers and dug into the topic of people being hurt by the phenomenon. And he'll tell you a high percentage of those experiencers who have been hurt or killed had weapons on them with intent to use them against whatever the phenomenon is. But I'm getting way off topic here as usual. The last cool thing I want to mention that one of the three whistleblowers said to the House Oversight Committee was they regularly tracked objects and continue to track the same type of craft, a black cube within a clear sphere.
During a training mission in Warning Area Whiskey 72, 10 miles off the coast of Virginia Beach, two F-18 Super Hornets were split by a UAP. The object, described as a dark gray or a black cube inside of a clear sphere, came within 50 feet of the lead aircraft and was estimated to be 5 to 15 feet in diameter. The mission commander terminated the flight immediately and returned to base. Our squadron submitted a safety report, but there was no official acknowledgement of the incident and no further mechanism to report the sightings. Soon, these encounters became so frequent that aircrew would discuss the risk of UAP as part of their regular pre-flight briefs.
Not your old-fashioned flying saucer. I'm on the side with the folks that think the UFO phenomenon has been here forever and that the way they appear to us changes as society does. Folks in biblical times saw flying chariots and flaming wheels, and that evolved into saucers. And now that half of our lives are spent in a digital dream world, we're getting fucking cubes floating within spheres. We are living through some wild shit, and that's for sure. So anyways, like I was just complaining about how we are facing a constant beatdown of mostly pointless information, I am going to contribute to that and do my best to beat you down with the kind of information that your brain is interested in. Fly tying. The topic I pretend this podcast is about. And this time, it's specifically about tube flies. Whether you already know more than I do about them or not, you made the choice to tune in and listen this far, not me. I'm typing up my homework right now, laying on my bed on my belly with my feet in the air like a teen girl on an important phone call.
Whatever.
Look, I've known more about UFOs than you have for a lot of years now, and I don't try to rub that in. Don't come at me telling me you're a tube doctor that doesn't need this information. I'm going to try and make it fun, okay?
Okay. Jeez Louise.
And you have nothing better to do. You're in your fucking car on a boring commute or something. Maybe you're on a walk. Maybe you're bored at work and pretending to be listening back to an important meeting to make the meeting minutes you just drafted look extra perfect for the big boss. I hope you don't accidentally try to hit pause when your boss comes up to talk to you and accidentally put it on speaker so everyone in the office hears me saying something completely out of context that sounds even crazier than it already was.
Yeah, I'm going to need to speak with you in my office. Privately.
I don't want that to happen, for your sake or mine. I want my show to be a tiny reason that makes your shitty drive or data entry project more tolerable. That's all I want. Well, that's a lie. I want to have the highest security clearance that any loony podcast wannabe can get, so I can get access to the goddamn skiff and know what my fellow skeletons in the government and intelligence community knows about UFOs. Sorry. Just the fact that my words are out there floating around the internet is good enough for me. I'm comfortable with an almost completely invisible audience. Being a struggling musician for most of my life has me well prepared for that. Besides, it's August in Sacramento, and it's way too hot to have a pretend argument with an invisible audience. It feels like I'm living in one of those Ghost Sun solar tube ovens. I typed out, I'm living in a convection oven, but then I remembered that infomercial about the solar tube oven. So I used that as the vehicle for this joke because this episode is about tubes. I have always loved infomercials, and with the advent of on-demand TV, I never get to watch them anymore. Technology has stolen that joy from me.
Meet the Go Sun Grill, a game-changing solar cooker that can bake, boil, and fry a meal in cloudy weather. The secret to this technology is our vacuum tube, which absorbs light, while acting as a perfect insulator.
The large volume of flies in my backyard are doing their best to steal joy from me too. I just want to go out there and sit in peace. There's nothing dead or rotting in my backyard, and I have one dog, and I pick up after it. I shouldn't have a fly problem. Flies should get the fucking point when I almost kill them over and over after they land on me and stop constantly gambling with their lives, but they don't. I've tried a few different methods of curtailing the issue without much luck. And don't think I don't recognize the irony of a fly-tying podcast host having a problem with flies in his backyard. It's just further proof that this is a digital prison planet simulation. As soon as summer hit, the flies made their presence known, and I started feeling defeat already. Just land on me. Cover me. I give up, and I give in to my insect overlords. My wife had more fight in her, though, and got creative. We had tried some fly-catching jars. You know, let's call them tubes. They had some kind of yeasty bait and water in them and a lid that allowed flies in, but not out. They worked okay, but the bait wasn't cheap enough, and the fly-catching tubes got pretty disgusting once they started filling up with piles of fly carcasses. My lovely wife hatched a plan to take that grody situation and make it even more grody. She pointed out that we had free bait that our dog produced a few times every day and that flies love it. They go hog wild for it. She tried to sell me on the idea of collecting our dog's poop and using that as bait in our fly-catching tubes. It's a thrifty, creative idea, I'll give her that. But we did not go forward with these plans after further discussion. It's just not the kind of science experiment that I want to do, even if it would mean some kind of secondary jankum revenue. If you don't know what that is, I'm not telling you. This part of the podcast is already gross enough, but I set that little jankum joke up on a tee, and I will always take a swing, okay? Back to tubes. Have you ever noticed how many delicious foods are tube-shaped? Hot dogs and sausages are the obvious first things that come to mind. There's also lots of vegetarian tubes, too, like carrots and pickles and my favorite, corn. Not the band. That shouldn't be anyone's favorite. And I don't like corn because it's a tube shape. It's because of the corn hair.
It has the juice.
The part that most people throw away with the husk. Next time you shuck some corn, do yourself a favor and save a pile of that delicious starchy hair. Ball it up tight and stuff it in your lip like a healthy dip. It's the tastiest alternative to chewing tobacco, and the Zyn Pouch Company executives are doing everything they can to keep people like us away from this plentiful natural product that could sink them and big tobacco altogether if people caught on to it. I'm sorry I'm so stupid. I can't help it.
It's okay. We forgive you.
Back to tubes. For real this time. Do you care about the origin of tying flies on tubes? I do, so I decided to look it up. The internet isn't super clear on this. One article I read claimed that the first tube fly was probably made by British author and angler Alexander Wanless, who, in his book The Angler and the Thread Line, that was released in 1932, showcases his tube fly system to the angling community. He was mostly a spin angler and was trying to incorporate some of the aspects of fly fishing into his spin setup. He even explains in almost the exact way that I saw April Vokey explain it in one of her far more recent YouTube videos. Here's Alexander's quote from his book. It has been observed that the first type of fly is designed so that when a fish is hooked, the fly will slide up the line out of harm's way, or rather, to prevent it from levering the small hook out of the salmon's jaw. But then you mosey over to Wikipedia, and right there on the tube fly page in the history section is this. Credit for the invention of the tube fly tying style belongs to fly dresser Minnie Morawski of the Charles Playfair Company, Aberdeen, Scotland. In 1945, she began experimenting with hollowed out sections of turkey quills as a base of traditional salmon and trout flies, rather than traditional hooks. Initial patterns were tied on top of the turkey quill tubes, but the tying style quickly evolved into tying patterns in the round and on plastic tubes. By the late 1950s, the advantages of the tube fly style were being hailed by Trout and Salmon magazine as the most important innovation in salmon fishing since the introduction of the greased line fishing techniques in the 1930s. Are they doing our main man Alexander dirty here? His book came out a good 10 years before old Minnie even got started. Is this the origin of spin anglers and fly anglers not always getting along? Probably not. It's Wikipedia. For about a year, the Jim Boys Taco Wikipedia had me listed as the writer and creator of the regional chain's official theme song. So anything can happen if you put your mind to it.
Bet you can't name another fast food restaurant that serves a taco burger. This is the theme song for Jim Boys.
Maybe the Tubefly Wiki page needs an update. In fact, yeah, fuck that. I just found another article that credits Alexander Wanless with the creation of the Tubefly, so I'm going to deem that as 100% historically accurate now and confirm that Wikipedia is spreading misinformation about our beloved hobby. Maybe I shouldn't be so hard on Minnie. Minnie actually appears to be the one who popularized tying tube flies amongst fly anglers. Alexander should have a brief mention on the Wikipedia page, though, if you ask me. Are anglers just bad at documenting this shit? Now I'm seeing Minnie Morawski referred to as Winnie Morawski. Who do I believe? Are these people even real, or are they all part of the grand illusion that keeps us under the thumb of the powers that be?
Matthew, calm down.
Anyways, tubes are versatile. You can make them any size you want.
That's what she said.
You can use whatever hook you like and change them out as you see fit without any damage to the fly at all. I'll cite April Vokey one more time, who was the second guest on this program, if you care to go back and listen to a very green podcast host interview a big star. One of her main selling points on tube flies that she shared in one of her YouTube videos and on my show was stacking them. You can mix and match and add or subtract as many flies as you want to create the exact profile and look that you want. So I've heard about a few DIY fly tying hacks that Nerdy Fly Tires have decided to use as their tubes during my research. We are a resourceful bunch, and I appreciate that quality that those of us in the highly esteemed fly tying community possess. People use WD-40 or other chemical aerosol spray straws, plastic Q-tips, coffee straws, computer duster spray straws, your dad's dick, your brother's dick, your own tiny little dick, all of the presidents of the United States dicks, Bigfoot's dick, and your dog's dick, to name a few. Listen, I had to make some more dick jokes there, and I'm sorry for going overboard. It just flowed out of me naturally. It makes me feel brand new again. The idea of tying on tubes had me feeling like a brand new fly tire, too. It's a whole new system of doing what I've grown used to doing, but after taking the dive into fly tying in general, I'm not afraid of any other expensive rabbit holes. It's just part of this, and we know that. I offered you some DIY hacks, so you don't technically have to spend a whole bunch of money to get started tying on tubes, but there are definitely some items out there that can make things a little more convenient and easy. When I decided to try my hand at tying tube flies, I drove to my local fly shop to pick up the essentials and walked my skeleton body over to the fly tying materials and pretended I knew what I was looking for. I had already spent some money on this little universal adapter tool for my vise that was supposed to be perfect for tying on both shanks and tubes. So I felt like all I really needed was some beads and weights and cones and things plus the actual tubes. I snagged a few packs of Pro Sport Fisher brand supplies. Not a sponsor, at least not yet.
Ik hou heel veel van je Pro Sport Fisher. Laten we iets laten gebeuren.
And Mike from the shop, who has been very helpful many times before, walks up to see if I need a hand. I tell him that I think I have what I need, but would love some advice since I'm brand new to tubing. That's what we call it, right? It's not tying when you're tying on tubes, it's called tubing. Like the old arcade game that absolutely no kid would waste their time playing these days. He said, wow, I hadn't heard that great and funny term for tying tube flies until now, but I hope it catches on, and I was like, yeah, I know, man. So Mike from the shop says, yeah, you need this little needle-looking adapter to clench your vise onto, and the tube slips over that and makes it nice and sturdy to tie on. I quickly tell him that I bought a pricey little adapter that does shanks and tubes, and he says, no, I'm pretty sure you will need this needle thing, just trust me. I'm a professional that works at this shop, and you are an obvious rookie. He didn't say it that way, but that's what he should have said, because I deflected that advice and did not buy the needle. I came home all excited for a heavy tubing sesh, and sure enough, I pop on the adapter I had purchased and stuck a tube in it.
That's what she said!
And it was more like the soft pornographic tube that I mentioned at the beginning of the show, that this episode is not about, than what I needed. I guess the idea with that adapter was that you can either put a needle in there or the tube itself far enough back that it would stay straight while you tie onto it. I needed a hard, straight, rigid tube to tie on.
That's what she said.
When I tried to tie on my setup, the tube basically bent in half as soon as I applied any pressure by wrapping thread on it. My local fly shop was absolutely correct that I needed that little needle. I was wrong, and it wasn't the first time. So I ordered one from the shop via their online store, so I didn't have to walk back in with shame and admit that I should have listened to them. So there's one example where the tools created by the people that make tube tying supplies are going to be very helpful. That's not saying you couldn't find a way to make your own needle to stick in your vise. I'm sure there are some resourceful people out there listening.
Why don't you put your tiny little dick in the jaws of your vise, Mark?
Hey, okay, I guess I deserved that for the jokes I made about everyone else's dicks earlier, or even. There are a few systems, or whatever you would like to call them out there, for tubing. I love calling it tubing, guys. I really hope that catches on and I'm seen as a pioneer. I just mentioned Pro Sport Fisher, and they seem to be the current leader in the game, and I say that with absolutely no real data to back it up. They just seem to be the most available and most well-known tube-tying supply company. I have heard that some shops have had a hard time keeping their stuff in stock, and they're based in Denmark, so these little tubes have a long way to travel to get to us here in the States. They really do seem to have all the bases covered with all types and sizes of tubes, beads, cone heads, weights, soft heads, flexi discs, hook guides, you name it. All of their stuff is designed to be used together and fit together perfectly. It's thoughtful, quality stuff. There are others offering up tube tying supplies like HMH and the FITS system, which stands for Froden Improved Tube System. Stonefoe has some stuff and many others. Most of the Vise companies all have some type of tube-specific jaws or adapter as well if you want to get something made specifically for your Vise. I'd relay the advice that my local fly shop tried to tell me and pass on the universal adapters. After learning from my own errors, I'd suggest buying something made by the company that manufactures your tube tying materials or something proprietary for your Vise. It's the foundation of your tubing experience, so make sure you have something sturdy that will actually work. Find the tubes you like. Cut them to size and get tubing. You know I'm already thinking about tube leeches.
This is a leech.
A tube leech is what you call a... Never mind. After I started watching more videos of people tying on tubes, I noticed that the basic process is a little backwards from what I was used to, with the bead or disc or eyes or whatever you choose going on last, and usually not actually tied in, but more often glued. There's also usually a piece of junction tubing that is sized slightly differently to keep the hook in place at the back of your fly. Some tubes come with that part built in already. You also get to inhale burning plastic fumes and melt down the tip of your tube as the final step in tying your tube fly in an almost freebase drug-type ritual.
That's why I was smoking. Sometimes dipping embalming fluid. And me and my friends would laugh and giggle and eat all the cookies. It was terrible.
There is no way the fish is going to eat your tube if it's not melted on the end, okay? They notice it every time. Don't be a dip, melt your tip. That's a sticker idea I've been working on for the tuber community. That is a part of tubing that raised some questions for me right away, actually. Everyone who ties on plastic tubes ends up melting down the tip of the tube that protrudes out in the front of the bead or eyes or just the front of the fly. And I either picked all the videos where the person tying didn't explain the reasoning behind it, or I got to the part of the video and started thinking about aliens or Jeffrey Epstein or something and missed it.
Oh, it was probably the aliens and Jeffrey Epstein, again.
I thought it might be because the ends of the tube were sharp if you cut them down and would end up damaging your leader. But it seems like it's more to clean up the front of your fly and eliminate any excess tube, and also to create a small ridge to keep the materials behind it in place. You're also required to use my fly tying exclusive $75 tube melting lighter that I sell in my make-believe e-commerce store. Or the melt job won't be up to fly tying standards and you won't be allowed to fish the tube flies that you create. I'm sorry, it's just the law. Obviously, if you're tying on a brass or some other type of hard metal tube, you aren't cutting them down or melting them. There's a 9/11 thermite conspiracy joke in here somewhere, and I've typed out a couple things that aren't good enough to make the cut. So just know that I wanted to make a melting steel beams joke for us and it didn't pan out, and that 9/11 was an inside job. I bought my first tube fly on accident. And just like when I bought my first intruder fly, I got home with it and I had no idea how to rig it. There wasn't a little loop for me to tie my leader onto. What the hell do I do? I remember the intruder making even less sense actually, and the hook and junction tube came in a separate little bag and I'm like, what is going on? There's a number of ways to rig them, and some of them seem overly complicated and it doesn't have to be that way. It's like using a loop knot to tie on your streamer. Most people will say it gives the fly more action, and it might. But there's plenty of people who just use the trusty clinch knot or improved clinch knot in that scenario and claim the difference is negligible. My dude Alvin Dito actually talked about that specifically in one of his recent YouTube videos. The simplest way to rig a tube fly is to run the leader right through it and then tie the end onto the hook of your choice. Bring the eye of that hook up into the back of your tube or the junction that you added to the back of your fly so that it's kind of secure in there and get to casting. The momentum from your cast and then the current in the river will pretty much keep things where you want them. I'm just trying to tell you that it's easy to overthink things in fly tying and fishing, but there is rarely a set way to do something in those worlds. Figure out what works for you and stop giving a care. I try to never give a care. It's been a while since I've reminded you that I am by no means a professional at fly tying or fishing. I like to think that I'm serviceable at both, and that is even up for debate. I'm just sharing the things that I'm learning with you in a way that I hope is a little more entertaining than reading Wikipedia. Do you still have questions? No? You're a pro tuber already? That's great, and I'm sorry I wasted your time. I still have some questions, though, and I'm guessing that some of you do too. There's no way I covered it all in my stupid monologue. I never do, even though they seem to be getting longer with every episode. This one was getting so long that I debated having a guest at all for this episode. But I've been looking for an excuse to give my buddy Jim Sens a call and pick his brain, so I did. Can you blame me? I needed someone to validate my internet tube findings. A real person, not AI. Plus, we got a small guest appearance by Jim's lovely wife, Anne, as a bonus treat. It's just a quick interview. Two cool-ass dudes talking about tubes. Just tubing, you know? If you've been listening to the show, you already know Jim Sens from the episode we did on the Mackenzie River. If you're a fly tire, you should have known him before he was on my dumb show. He's a total sweetheart, and I'm honored to call him a friend and have him back on the show. Here's our chat, you little tube lickers.
From now on, we will travel in tubes! Get the scientists working on the tube technology immediately.
All right, Jim, let's get going on this, man. I got some questions for you.
Hopefully I have some answers.
I bet you do. And, you know, I'm gonna start out apologizing. I'm sorry in advance for this question, but it became a joke at my office, my old office, to call someone's dick their piss tube. And you are a piercer by trade. Have you pierced any piss tubes lately? And do you keep a career count?
I do not keep a career count, but I usually do anywhere from, I'd say, average 6 to 12 a month.
No way. That surprises me.
My favorite terminology for it is spam javelin. I learned that one in Hawaii.
That's good. Spam.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just cooked some spam up yesterday. Enjoy it.
Yep. See? Yeah. Now I just ruined spam for everybody.
No, I didn't ruin it, man. Still good. Still good.
The people that like it, love it. The people that hate it, it'll just hate it no matter what anyway.
Yeah. Whatever, man. Eating it raw, though, like raw. I mean, it's cooked, but like without cooking it again, that's a little weird.
Yo, 100%.
Anyway.
It tastes so much better once you cook it. And you have to like get it a little crispy on the outside.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, to regular tubes, do you like tying tube flies?
I love tying tube flies. I tie a lot of sylvanators. That's probably like a pink and purple sylvanator is probably the fly that I've caught the most steelhead on.
Yeah, is it a nice little change up from the more traditional stuff? I imagine you're tying all the time.
It's still a really quick, easy guide fly. It's literally just like a bunny leech, a couple ostrich, some flash, and then a hackle around it, and a little bit of flash, and then a bead, and call it good. So it's got like that minimalistic thing to it. It's basically like Jonathan Farmer's graboid, but like stripped down to the most basic core.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I've probably tied a lot of those for shops and for friends and stuff.
You're tying tubes commercially too?
A little bit, yeah. Not as much now that the steelhead numbers are where they are, which is a whole nother topic that we can get into. Mm-hmm. But yes, when steelhead was good, totally.
When did you first come across tube flies? Do you remember first time you saw one or got into tying them or anything?
I saw Bruce Berry tying on some tube flies on Caddis Flies YouTube page, and that's what kind of sparked my interest in them. And then a lot of the Scandinavian tubes, those things are amazing for like Atlantic salmon and stuff. They're so cool, and they're so small and minimalistic. They're just tiny little
ones.
Yeah, like Arctic fox and a hackle, and you call it like good. Maybe a little bit of flash, but like
a tiny
like
tube,
basic permit. Yeah,
yeah, totally. with a big long wing on it and stuff like that. You see those a lot. Yeah, it was interesting to me. I didn't realize how long they've been around. Like digging into the topic, from what I read, it seemed that like the in the 30s, I forget the person's name now, who was trying to incorporate some fly fishing stuff into spin fishing and birth, you know, the tube fly idea. Somebody else, I think her name was Minnie Murawski, popularized it with the fly community. But she was tying on stuff like turkey quills and stuff like that hollowed out. It was really interesting to read up on the history. I shared a little bit of it in the monologue before this.
Brass tubes are always really interesting too, instead of the plastic tubes that most of us tie on, like people tie on black brass or aluminum tubes. That's really cool too.
Yeah, I don't have any of those, and I'm assuming that's just so you don't have to add weight and stuff like that, or is it for flash too?
I think it's mainly just a weight issue. It just gives them some added depth to the fly.
It really seems that, and I might be mistaken or misunderstanding it, but it seems like that there's more glue used on tubes than regular flies. Is that Am I totally off base there?
No. Glue is definitely, on tube flies especially, it's really nice, especially when you're tying on like the Pro Sport Fisher tubes that are like 3 inches long, but you're only using like an inch of it. So you've got like 2 inches more. It's nice to just throw a little bit of glue on your thread, wrap it around, and then cut it off and call it good. Because trying to get a whip finish on that, unless you're doing it by hand, can be a little tricksy. Unless you get like a really big whip finisher, which I do have one sitting right here, like this guy.
It's huge. Extendo one.
But they're not that easy to use. So
yeah, I haven't even, I don't know why I haven't tried. I haven't tried to do it by hand. I always use my little whip finish tool. It always looks so cool when somebody does it, though, man.
I feel like I can't get the knot as tight when I do it by hand. It's just it, and I'm not as good at precisely putting down my thread when I'm doing the whip finish part as I am if I'm using the tool. It just gets more sloppy, and I feel like it's just a looser knot. Mm-hmm. So it's probably because I just rarely ever use a hand whip finish unless I just forgot mine somewhere or somewhere along those lines.
So how long after you saw that video you were talking about did it take you to jump in and get some stuff and start tying on them?
Oh, it was probably right after I watched his video. Bruce Berry was a huge motivator for me when I first started tying steelhead flies in particular. I just loved his outlook on them and just him as a human. He just seemed like a really cool guy. I've actually been lucky enough to meet him, and he is actually a really cool guy, which makes me happy.
It's always nice, yeah.
When you look up to someone and then you meet him and they're not as nice as you had hoped, that always sucks.
I've had that. I mean, met a lot of people in music that I was a little disappointed with. I don't want to talk shit. It's just
Totally.
You never know.
I've met lots of actors and it's basically 50-50 on if they're a cool person or not. So
what are the advantages you see in fishing tube flies?
You don't have to tie in a trailer hook like when you're trying to do a bigger fly, so that's really nice. Tying intruders on tubes is really nice. Jonathan Farmer's Beast of Burden would be a great tube fly. His graboid, I've tied that as a tube fly, and that's amazing for getting out there and having fun with.
One of the first things I thought of when I got to tube stuff, I wanted to try one of those on a tube.
Yeah, it translates really well, and then you don't have to do the whole fire line trailer hook thing and like getting
the hardest part for me too. So yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, it just cuts all of anything with a trailing hook, cuts it all out, because you just do it on the river. Just tie a loop knot in the end and pull it in and you're good. I use mainly the Pro Fishers tubes, but I have played around with the Aqua Flies tubes. The Pro Sport Fisher tubes are my favorite. I like those ones a lot.
Yeah, they seem to have like a really thoughtful system.
Totally.
From start to finish. What's the difference between those and the Aquafly tubes?
Aquafly tubes, they have them in, I think, 3, maybe 4 different sizes. And it's like 1 millimeter, 2 millimeter, 3 millimeter. Yeah, I think it's 3 sizes. But you can like, you cut them and then you basically glue them together to create your little junction out the back. Yeah. So
the Pro Sport Fisher ones have that little built in.
Yeah. You can either get the 50-50 tubes, which has a bigger end, or 40-40, whatever they call them, and then a skinnier end that's all one piece. Or the ones I like from Pro Sport Fisher are the ones with the silicone little clip on that you just snap onto the back end of the tube. Those ones are my favorite. I just feel like they make me the happiest when I'm tying on them.
That's cool. So, I mean, what about disadvantages? Do you see anything that's I feel like I always worry about it staying in place because it's sort of loose on your, you know, loose on your leader.
Yeah, it kind of depends on how you tie the hook in, which is hard to describe verbally without video representation. But you can definitely make the hook sit pretty stiff on the end of it if you really want to.
Just by the size of your knot or the type of your knot or whatever it's.
Yeah, and you can also like, junction. I don't know if this is going to make any sense, but you take your mono and you do a non-slip loop knot. So you've just got your mono and your little loop. You pinch that loop down so it's really small. You fish that through the eye of the hook and up over the bend and over the point, and then snug it up so it kind of like half hitches around the eye of the hook. Yeah. And that'll like stand the hookup better so it's not so like floppy loose all over the place.
Hey, that's what she said.
That's the way that most of my friends that I go fishing with, that's how we do it. And then you just make the loop longer or shorter depending on how far back you want that hook to sit. I try to tie it so the bend of the hook is right at wherever the last materials end.
Got it. Yeah. I was going to ask you how you preferred to rig them too, because anytime I've ever fished them, I just go straight improved clinch knot or something down to the hook and sink it into the junction. You know, I don't do anything fancy, but I see a lot of different ways to do it.
I just kind of like make a, I know your audience isn't going to be able to see this, but I make a loop. Mm-hmm. I'm going to make it bigger. And then I take that loop. So I've just got the loop and I do like a around my finger to create an opening to slip that loop through.
Yeah, kind of like the a surgeon's knot there.
Yeah, like a double surgeon's knot, basically. Mm-hmm. And then that's exactly how I do it. And then
loop knotting it onto the hook then.
Yeah. And if the hook breaks off, if that like where it wraps around the hook, if that breaks off, usually that knot will hold the tube still so you don't lose your fly. You just lost the hook.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Which is also kind of nice.
Yeah, I mean, I really dig that you can swap out hooks, add a stack up your tubes, have two small ones on, they do all kinds of different stuff.
Totally. I remember April Vokey talking about that like years ago on one of her videos that she did. She just does like little marabou pom-pom tufts basically of flies, and then she'll like stack them together
saw the same thing for sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I love that video. That was a huge aha moment in my head.
Yeah, for sure, man. And the way that you just gave me with the way to rig the hook too, because that's the same kind of way we'll do in surf fishing, you know, and you'll have multiple kind of those surgeon type knots with loops off the side of the leader, you know, where you have like three or four of them and then one at the bottom.
Yep.
So that makes a lot of sense. I'm probably going to try that.
It holds the hook way better than doing like an improved clinch knot or whatever on the end of it.
I mean, I like too that you can fish something and you're totally, it's weightless basically, right? And you're using just the sink tip instead of having any weight on the fly.
Yeah. Yep. I fish a lot of brass beads because I use the Pro Sport Fishers, their whole things, because their beads work really well on their tubes. Mm-hmm. So I'll use like their brass beads, which really aren't that heavy. So most of the time I'm doing a sink tip. The heavier the fly gets, the harder it is to cast. Like when you're doing two hands, they're trying to get that up out of the water is a nightmare. So I'd much rather make my sink tip heavier or lighter, depending on what area of the water column I want to ride in.
Yeah, I mean, I'm even thinking now like doing like little clouser type tubes too. I mean, I saw another one of my guests, Britta Fordyce, was posting some clousers that they're really really sparse clousers with a stinger hook off the back instead of the kind of normal clouser style, and they were super sweet. And I don't know why I never thought of tying them that way, but it makes me want to tie them on tubes too.
It's a great idea.
So what type of setup do you use for tying on tubes?
Well, again, the Pro Sport Fisher, I have the little like...
The needle, yeah. Yeah,
yeah, the little needles. I have both sizes. And then the Portland Fly Shop, for judging a fly tying contest over the winter, gave me one of the Regal tube heads that I can just like clip into this thing.
So what does the tube stick into that piece on the end there?
There's little mandrels that I stick in here.
Okay.
I don't know where those are right now, but there's little mandrels that I just stick in this part.
That's the post. Yeah.
Yeah. And that'll hold the tubes for me. And they come in different sizes too for whatever tubes. So if I happen to not be tying on Pro Sport Fisher and I'm using the Aqua tubes, that head will work really well because it comes with different sizes to be able to match whatever I need it to do.
That's cool. Yeah, I got the needle too. I bought this weird little universal adapter at first and it didn't really work. I ended up buying a needle like the one you just showed there.
Yeah, I've tried a few of the other things too, like the HMH and a few other ones. And I just settled on the Pro Sport Fisher mandrel needle thing.
That's cool. Yeah, do you get any custom order requests for tubes often?
Not so far this year because of the numbers of steelhead in Oregon are so low. But I used to, yes.
I don't know why. Like, I mean, it seemed so foreign compared to what I was just getting used to tying that I kind of put off tying on tubes for a long time for some reason. Why do you think someone who's just getting into tying shouldn't be afraid to get that kind of stuff and try? Like, I always trip out because it seems like you're tying kind of backwards, you know?
Definitely. Tubes are just really nice because there's no hook to hook yourself with. I know that doesn't get talked about a lot, but we definitely hit the points of hooks a lot on our fingers. Yeah. So if you're worried about tying on tubes, it makes it exponentially nicer because you don't have a sharp thing that you're dragging your fingertips across all the time. My fingers always have like pock marks.
Yeah.
I don't know if you can see those.
I can see them, yeah.
Always on my thumb right there. I always have little pock marks from just a little like tink tink on the point of the needle. Even on this little tiny size 12 that I'm dying on, I'll hit that point.
Yeah.
So that's kind of fun. You don't have a sharp thing there. Yeah, but anything you can tie on anything steelhead or even like trout spay related that you can tie on a shank or a more traditional hook, you can just tie it on a tube fly and call it good.
Yeah,
you can make a fly as big or as small as you want too, which is really nice because generally they are whatever length you want them to be.
Totally, yeah. And you can pet them for as long as you want, as hard as you want.
Yeah, and they don't bite.
what are some patterns that you cannot tie on tubes?
Dry flies. No, I take that back. I've seen steelhead bombers on tubes.
Like more
a lot of the smaller like a, trout flies.
Like a, yeah, like a skater kind of thing? Or
yeah, skaters, yeah. For sure.
Yeah.
Skaters have definitely been tied on tubes, and they work really well. Have I tried one? No. But I know people have. Anything trouty, like if it needs to mimic an insect, it's pretty hard. I guess you could tie a mouse pattern really well on a tube because it's something meaty enough to be able to get on a tube.
Yeah, I wonder how that would work. I wonder how you'd do that. It has such a fat body usually, like a big profile on them too.
Yeah, totally. There's this fly tire. His name is Joel. He lives out in Central Oregon. He does a lot of traditional steelhead patterns. And over the winter, he did a series where he'd take traditional steelhead patterns and tie them on tubes. And they looked really cool. I love that guy. He's such a rad person. I'll try to find his page and send it to you on Instagram.
Please do.
But yeah, he did a whole series of just taking a traditional salmon or steelhead fly and putting it on a tube, and it looked really cool. He did a really nice job with them all.
Like the traditional Victorian salmon fly type stuff? Oh, wow.
Yep. Probably, I'd say a little bit more simplistic, like the D-wings and stuff like that, those type of flies. I don't remember him doing a full-on like classic salmon fly. Definitely more steelhead inspired because he steelheads on the Deschutes all the time.
So when steelhead numbers are better, you see a lot of folks fishing those in your area?
Yeah, tubes. Totally.
Yeah.
Yep.
I really never come across anybody on the river fishing tubes here in Sacramento. I mean, on the American River. And there's a lot of folks that swing it too. I never see tubes. I don't know why. Hasn't really hit here yet, I guess. I don't know. Do you see anything else coming up in the fly tying world that could be like filling like a similar space as tube flies, like a new little corner of the hobby, like anything new and innovative like that?
I haven't seen too much lately. Fly tying company that's been coming up. I've really been enjoying Semperfly, their products. Like I'm addicted to their thread, which I tie on all the time now. But a lot of their products are pretty cool and fun and make you think a little bit differently on some things, which is really nice. Hairline's still obviously the big dog in the world, but Semperfly is definitely trying really hard to come up on its game.
Yeah, do you have a thread size preference from Semperfly? I get caught. I feel like I'm always using 8-0 Vivas after tying with Jonathan a couple times on Zoom.
When I was tying with Jonathan a lot, I was using 8-0 Vivas a lot. And then once we went our separate ways, I dropped down to 10-0, and I realized 10-0 was really nice. And Semperfly's 8-0 is basically Vivas's 10-0. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So It's a really nice thread, and it's lightly waxed, which is nice versus a Beavis that isn't waxed at all. Yeah, I like this thread a lot. It's really strong. It's pretty rare that I break it, just like the Beavis stuff. It's just a UK thing, so it's harder for us to get it consistently here. So when I run out of things, it's more of a journey to find them.
Well, it's what I'm starting to see with some of the Pro Sport Fisher stuff, too, that I've noticed some shops having a hard time keeping it in stock, you know?
Totally.
They're in Denmark or something, yeah.
Yeah, Bruce Berry's actually up in Washington. He's the one, the representative for...
Oh, really? Yeah.
I don't know if it's just our coast or if it's the whole United States, but he's the rep for all of it. And the last time I talked to him was over the winter, and he said that they were having some molding problems that was keeping them from being able to do production very well. And I don't know if those have gotten fixed yet or not. I haven't been tying on tubes because, again, steelhead numbers are terrible. So people just aren't asking for them like they normally do.
Is there any talk of closures or anything with the numbers being low?
They closed the North Umpqua.
Oh, they did? Yeah.
They closed most of the Columbia and Willamette for salmon this year.
Yeah, it's closed in California completely, right?
Yeah. So there's definitely been closures. They haven't closed anything steelhead related on the Willamette, which is the river that I normally fish for steelhead.
Uh-huh.
But the numbers are so small that most people don't even bother to go try.
Where you been fishing, man?
Mainly just been fishing my home river right out the back door.
Oh, yeah. It's beautiful. I would be, too.
It's pretty amazing.
It really is, man.
I had my daughter and her best friend out. They visited me from Hawaii.
Oh, right.
A couple weeks ago. And I got to take them on the river for the first time in the drift boat when it was actually nice. And they loved it.
Oh, yeah.
We caught a bunch of little rainbow trout. And they just had fun. Sweet. It was good. It was super fun.
Your daughter's not in Maui, is she?
Mm-mm. No. She's
seen all the crazy fires over there.
Yeah. One of her really good friends, it was actually her boyfriend for 4 years through college. And they broke up after they got out of college. His dad, it's like his home in Maui, burned to the ground. They were in Lanai or
Lahaina.
There you go. Yeah. And it's burned to the ground. I saw it and I messaged him really quick and just sent my heartfelt sorries and let me know if there's anything you can do. I got to meet his dad. His dad was really nice.
Yeah.
Thankfully, his whole family's okay and they got evacuated to the other side of the island where his grandma's house is. So.
Yeah, man, it's wild.
It's crazy how quick it just went through. Yeah. It just decimated everything.
Glad to hear
right now, okay. As I sit here, we're surrounded by forest fires.
Is there fires up there right now?
Yeah, there's one in each direction except for west. It's basically like a triangle and we're sitting right in the middle of them all.
Yeah, well, floating down the Mackenzie when I was up there a month ago or whatever, saw all the devastation from the last time it came through. So
yeah, thankfully that burn will probably keep any fires from being major in our area again anytime soon.
Kind of true, huh?
That's like the only bonus of these things.
Natural fire line, yeah.
Yep. So
I hope things get under control up there. I it happens here in Northern California every year too, you know. I walked out my back door the other night and thought I smelled fire. I was like, oh, shit, where is it now? But it wasn't anything. Just glad nothing big's happened yet around here.
Everybody in our neighborhood uses this app called, what's it called?
Watch Duty.
It's a wildfire app. You can see the blue dot is where we are. And that's all the fires around us right now.
My father-in-law. See, it's my sister's husband's dad. Is that my father-in-law?
Sister's husband's dad? Sure. We can call him your father-in-law. Well,
whatever, yeah. He's rad. He bought a fire truck. So he had a fire truck just parked at his house, filled up with water, you know, in case anything came through. It's like, hell yeah, that's a good investment.
That's actually kind of awesome.
They're
if you have the income for it.
Yeah, they're deep in the you know, not super deep, but deep enough where they have a long driveway, and if there was fire nearby, they'd be in trouble. So pretty
just
cool, man.
Changed the oil on the generator today and made sure it was all in good working order, because they coming up on this time of the year, they usually shut the power off for a few days here and there when the east winds are coming through.
Yeah, they do that around
here. So make sure that we can have power and all that still.
Wild times, man. Are you watching the UFO news?
I haven't been. Well, huh? I have been, but I haven't been keeping super close eye on. I feel like I'm in the camp of the majority of Americans where we're like, of course there's aliens. And then I just move on with my life instead of being like, holy crap, there's aliens.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I touched on that in the monologue for this episode too. Just that it's kind of odd that it isn't something everybody's talking about, but it's not just that people aren't interested either. There's a lot of people I think that, like you just said, that are like, have been feeling that way for a long time, and hearing something on, like, you know, CNN or whatever doesn't really change the Richter scale, doesn't change or whatever, you know.
No, not at all.
But it's a super fun, interesting time to be somebody into that stuff, I'm tell you.
I just wish that the government would give us like firm, like, yes, here's what your taxpayer dollars have been dealing with.
Yeah, so right.
Here's all the proof.
It's just
not going to happen that way.
Yeah, and then again too, like, if they come out and say something concrete, like, how am I going to believe them?
Like, right?
I don't know. Even if it's exactly what I want to hear, you know, I'll come up with a reason not to believe it.
We live in a world of distrust and disbelief at this point.
That I would say that the UFO community is split on that and that idea in general, where they're like, well, you know, this information about supposed disclosures coming from people we don't trust anyway. So what's behind it, or, you know, and
right,
a bunch of folks that are excited that things are finally happening and feeling validation. And I don't know, either way, everybody's feeling one way or the other about it. It's polarizing for sure.
It's just like everything in the world nowadays.
Yeah, I don't know how political it is. I'm sure there's a lot
like
of that
to go
in there
fishing.
Too.
Fuck, screw the politics.
Me too. Oh man. Well, I don't have any more tube questions. Those are the only ones I prepared, man.
Oh, all right.
I was just really coming up with the excuse to talk to you again.
I'm really stoked. Yeah, I'm really stoked to get a chance to talk again. What have you tied on tubes?
Me?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I haven't tied anything that I've been confident enough to show any of my friends yet. Definitely leeches. And I don't know what to call. I guess it would be more like a single stage intruder kind of thing. You know, I don't really have a name for it, just freestyling some stuff. But I'm really just getting into it. I have, like, if you look at my phone right now on my browser, I have like 20 different tube fly YouTubes open. They're like all the ones that I'm getting ready to try.
Yeah. But I like it.
Soon. I think I want to like do something like exclusively fish on tubes for a few months and like just totally dive in.
What you need to do is, do you have any silver pheasant?
I don't.
Or guinea?
I do have guinea. Yeah.
What color?
I have a few colors. I have a spotted, the natural spotted one, and then I have some fluorescent kind of stuff.
Do you have purple?
If I don't have purple gadwall.
Ooh, that'd work too. So take some pink marabou, two strands of whatever color flash you like, and that guinea or gadwall, whichever, as like a finishing wrap on the front.
Yeah.
Put a bead on the front of it, cut it off, go fish it. It'll take you like 3 minutes to tie, maybe. And only do like 2.5 turns of marabou.
I like tying with marabou. I see a lot of marabou on tubes. What if somebody wanted to tie one with some polar bear hair? What would I do?
Well, you gotta get some polar bear. I have never tried that. I do have a little bit laying around here that I might try that now that you brought it up. It's just, it's so rare. It's hard to like justify experimenting with it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense.
So that's another thing. I seem to remember like some old Jerry French and Ed Ward interviews. I don't even remember where I saw them, but they were talking about polar bear on intruder flies and how it worked really well for those. But again, I don't know if I'd rip through the little bit that I happen to come across for something like that.
Yeah. I also have a very tiny amount that a pal gave me that I've been, again, amassing YouTube videos of, like, what do I use it on? Because I don't want to waste it.
Mm-hmm. You know? Totally. It's just, it's a hard one. I did, Portland Fly Shop had me tie some more traditional steelhead flies for a guy that was going fishing on the Deschutes. Mm-hmm. And I did use some of the polar bear for wing material on one of his flies just because I wanted to do something cool. Mm-hmm. So he got some genuine polar bear for the wing on his more traditional steelhead flies.
Sweet.
So, and it looked really cool and kind of helped justify the price that he was going to be paying for the steelhead flies. I wanted to do something extra special and hopefully make his heart a little bit extra happy when he got them.
I'm sure he was. I'm sure it was.
Yeah.
Hey, I have one other question. And Ann might need to chime in on this one, but I saw you making fucking cheesecake s'mores one time.
Oh, dude. Next time you're up.
Both you guys just groan at the same time.
I didn't take a weed gummy before this interview because I wanted to have my brain working, but taking a weed gummy and eating one of those things is one of the best things ever.
Not even cheesecake. It was Asian steamed cheesecakes.
That's what I was wondering, because when I saw you guys post that, like, I was, believe me, I started Googling, like, what do I need? What do I need? And I went down the route of steamed cheesecake in general, which I didn't know was a thing, but is it more common than I thought?
Apparently easy to make. It's like a cheesecake souffle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's like four ingredients.
But you made the cheesecake too. You didn't buy the little packaged ones. You can get those little Asian cheesecake. Almost the same kind of size that you.
We bought them.
Yeah, we bought them. Okay. And then now we're learning that we can just make them ourselves. But yeah, we bought them, and then you like slice them lengthwise in half, mm-hmm. and then you put your chocolate and your roasted marshmallow in it. Yeah. Oh. It's so amazing. Next time you're up, no matter if it's 100 degrees outside, we're making these.
I'm way down. I haven't tried it yet, but I'm gonna.
Man, I'm gonna make sure it's a thing.
Yeah.
Even if your kids are with, I'll make sure I have plenty for everybody.
Dude, I have a horrible sweet tooth. Like ever since I was a kid, my parents couldn't hide anything from me. I mean, I'd find it, but even now, I'm 42, and like. I will eat all of my kids' Halloween candy. Like, I'll eat it all.
Technically, it's in your house.
Yeah, I mean, it's the dad tax, but like, I will eat it all. Like, I will eat it all. I'll go through it, prioritize it into what I'm eating first, and then as I get on, I'm eating the stuff I don't even like anymore.
Yeah,
because
you know what I mean? It's just there.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a joke with my brothers, but I think I have an ice cream cone every night.
I just had ice cream with some homemade blackberry cobbler that Ann made the other day.
Your berries? Yeah.
Yeah, it was so good.
I was just saying, we got an ice cream maker. That's also a game changer. Yeah. Highly recommend.
Oh, yeah.
What are those things called? The eye creamy?
Ninja creamy.
Ninja creamy.
Is it the one that you were mixing stuff up on when I was over there?
Yeah, when we made the margaritas. Yeah.
I was telling my wife about that, and it turned out that my sister has one. And she's like, oh, this? And she shows it to me in the kitchen. I'm like, yeah, that thing right there. I need to get one of those, man, because that thing was sweet.
Yep, especially if you have a sweet tooth, because you make any flavor ice cream you could possibly even dream of.
I do. I get the Tillamook ice cream, you know?
I love Tillamook.
I could go through a couple courses of that a week. I try not to. I try to have a cone. And not a big one, just a scoop. It's what I gotta do. It makes me happy, man. Whatever.
Yeah. it's our life. We get to live it how we want. As long as we're not hurting other people.
Fucking 42. I want an ice cream cone every day.
Mm-hmm. I don't even know when after dinner dessert started for me, but it's definitely like the last 4 or 5 years. It's like even before I logged on for the podcast tonight, I was like, oh, I gotta have my vanilla ice cream with the blackberry cobbler before I gotta eat it at like 6:30, so I'm done with it by the time I gotta log on.
I did real good on the cobbler.
I love it. I love it. That's where we're ending this one. Talking about sweets.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's where it went. Thank you, Jim.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thank you.
I'm really stoked that we got to talk about sweets because it's amazing. And anybody judging us out there for that s'mores idea with the steamed cheesecake?
Judging.
Just try it and then message me saying thank you later.
Nobody's judging over that one. They're just jealous. Just absolutely jealous.
Oh, I'm sure there's someone out there going, that's not s'mores. You're right. It's not. It's like, better.
Why? Why? Why didn't I do this? Why didn't I already do it?
I'm brilliant.
I'm amazed it's not already a huge thing in the world.
Yeah. Because I haven't designed it.
I agree with you. And that's you. If that was your concoction, genius.
Mm-hmm. Yep. She comes up with some really good ideas. There are also times where I'm doing the dishes and it gets pepper spray because of our hot sauce matter gets vaporized by hot water and then it gets inhaled into my lungs.
You're just inhaling hot gases.
Yeah. Once a month.
Well, yeah, once a month. That's way more than other people's husbands have to deal with.
Right. I love Jim. I wish I was his neighbor. He's a big reason that I jumped into fly tying in the first place, and he continues to inspire me at the Vise and just as a human. You'll know what I mean if you ever have the pleasure of meeting Jim. He's got an infectious smile and a great positive outlook on life. Thanks again, Jim. And one more thank you to you and Anne and River for making me feel at home as soon as I stepped foot on your property earlier this summer. I can't wait to come back up there and go fishing with you and make cheesecake s'mores on your porch. Tubes are cool. Don't be afraid. Try something new. What's the worst that could happen? You suck at it and don't like it and won't do it again? That's a horrible excuse. If you do that, do me a favor and send me your unused tube supplies. Season 2 is almost over. Thanks to those of you that have been sticking it out with me since the first season, and thanks to anyone new that is just finding the show. I'm working on something different to wrap the season up, and I hope it comes together the way I want it to. If you have any ideas for fly patterns or places I should dedicate episodes to or people I should interview in Season 3, please send me a DM on Instagram or send me an email to ssftpodcast@gmail.com. I'm going to close this now and drop in the info about these two organizations I dig. Mental health has been a loose theme of Season 2, and these two orgs do a great job occupying that space in our little fly fishing universe. I'm trying to fill the weird or dumb space in that same universe, and I promise to continue getting dumber and weirder if you just promise to continue listening. Project Healing Waters brings a high-quality, full-spectrum fly fishing program to an ever-expanding number of veterans in need at over 200 locations nationwide. Project Healing Waters programs meet regularly throughout the year with volunteers teaching the basics and advanced techniques while building long-term relationships. It's much more than a one-time fly fishing trip. The program provides basic fly fishing, fly casting, fly tying, and rod building classes for participants whose skills range from beginners who have never fished before to those with prior fly fishing and tying experience. All fly fishing and tying equipment is provided to the participants at no cost. Fishing trips, both one day and multi-day, are also provided free of charge to participants. Visit projecthealingwaters.org to learn more. Fishing the Good Fight is breaking down walls, smashing taboos, and building community. They believe that experiences in nature are an important part of caring for one's mental health. Less than 20% of men struggling with mental illness and or substance abuse are receiving professional support. The combination of a healthy therapeutic outlet, talk therapy, and a strong community will lead to mental well-being. Men face specific challenges when it comes to addressing mental health issues. According to Mental Health America, 6 million men living in the U.S. suffer from depression. In a National Center for Health Statistics studies, nearly 1 in 10 men reported experiencing some form of depression, but less than half sought treatment. 70% of all people who die by suicide are men. That's from the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Men are often reluctant to seek help, particularly for depression, and are far less likely to access professional mental health services than women. Men make up less than 25% of people treated for depression and or substance abuse. For a lot of men, Fishing the Good Fight program, such as a retreat, is the first time they have opened up about struggles they face, and 100% of men who attended a recent retreat indicated that they would seek professional help after the treatment. If you've ever wondered about your own mental health and wanted to improve quality of life, Fishing the Good Fight can provide the tools, resources, and support to guide you along your wellness journey. FishingTheGoodFight.org has more information.
This episode of the Secret Society of Fly Tires is brought to you by Tubes. Tubes are the only shape that's tube-shaped. I'm right if you think about it. Thanks, Tubes. Thank you for your shape and for sponsoring this episode. Buy Tubes today from any reputable tube dealer. Supplies are limited and this introductory offer won't last long. Call now. Stock up on Tubes today before they're gone forever. Shapes can disappear, you know. It happens all the time. Not with the popular ones like squares or triangles, but shapes do disappear, so don't be caught with your pants down if tubes suddenly disappear. Buy Tubes today. This episode of the Secret Society of Fly Tires is brought to you by Hardy. No, not the highly esteemed British fly fishing reel manufacturer with a storied history and unmatched quality. I'm talking about a different Hardy, the guy who invented Hardee's, the restaurant that's also called Carl's Jr. Here's what I don't understand. Why didn't Hardy just name all of them Hardee's? Why are some called Carl's Jr.? And what kind of name is Carl's Jr.? Why do restaurants do that? I mean, why do they have a possessive noun followed by a word that doesn't make sense? Ruth's Chris is another one. What's the big idea? Thanks, Hardy, for sponsoring this episode. We love your hamburger meat and flavorful sauces that you serve to happy customers daily. Please note that this is not a real advertisement, and the company, brand, entity, or product mentioned in the preceding ad in no way endorses, agrees with, or knows about this podcast.